From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The hurricane in New Orleans is only the proximate cause of the, and subsequent flooding are only the proximate cause of the disaster that we see unfolding before us in New Orleans. The real cause is poverty. And in New Orleans, as elsewhere in the United States, poverty is inextricably linked to race and class.
We'll talk with three residents of New Orleans who were forced to flee. We'll talk to them about who gets saved and who doesn't, and even the question, will New Orleans be rebuilt? And missed opportunities, how a Navy ship with food and water was turned back. We'll also look at a micro radio station that is being set up at the Houston Astrodome. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newly leaked memos are showing FEMA waited 5 hours after Hurricane Katrina had struck before requesting help to be dispatched to the region. Even then, Michael Brown, the director of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, said 1,000 Homeland Security employees were needed, but that they could take 2 days to show up at the disaster scene. Brown's memo to Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff politely ended, quote, "Thank you for your consideration and helping us to meet our responsibilities." According to the Associated Press, Brown's memo lacked any urgent language besides describing the hurricane as a, quote, "near catastrophic event." Brown's memo told employees would be expected to, quote, "convey a positive image of disaster operations to government officials, community organizations, and the general public." While FEMA took days to send help, tens of thousands of Gulf Coast residents were left without food, water, or a safe place to stay. The memo was leaked as criticism of Brown increases. On Tuesday, Democratic Senator Ken Salazar joined the growing chorus of calls for Brown's resignation. There are also many, including former President Clinton, calling for an independent investigation into the government's response. Meanwhile, President Bush announced on Tuesday that he'll personally lead an investigation into the government's response to the hurricane. He said, quote, "If things went wrong, we'll correct them."
Important for us to understand the relationship between the federal government, the state government, the local government when it comes to a major catastrophe. And the reason it's important is that we still live in an unsettled world. We want to make sure that we can respond properly if there's a WMD attack or another major storm. And so I'm going to find out over time what went right and what went wrong.
That was President Bush speaking with reporters Tuesday morning. Bush had invited reporters into the cabinet room at 11:08 yesterday morning, 7 minutes before Senator Susan Collins and Joseph Lieberman had scheduled their announcement of a Senate investigation into the response. In New Orleans, Mayor Ray Nagin has ordered law enforcement to forcibly remove any residents remaining in the city. Fires continue to spread, and fear is growing over the toxicity of the flood water. Officials have announced they plan to temporarily take all corpses to St. Gabriel, a small town used to be a leper colony. Mayor Nagin warned horrific sights will be seen once the city is drained of the floodwater. He said, quote, "It's going to be awful, and it's going to wake the nation up again." 60% of New Orleans remains flooded. Officials are estimating as many as 160,000 homes have been submerged or destroyed. Over 300,000 households in Louisiana alone have registered with FEMA for temporary housing and other forms of disaster relief. 145,000 people are staying in Red Cross shelters across 41 states. The vast majority are in shelters in Texas and Louisiana. The Red Cross is also reporting some 94,000 names have been registered on a website created to help people trace their relatives. In environmental news, officials are warning it could take years to restore clean drinking water in New Orleans. Mayor Nagin's office said E. coli bacteria has been found in the floodwater contaminated by sewage, dead bodies, and toxic chemicals washed out of oil refineries, hospitals, and other industrial plants. According to ABC News, floodwater in the city's Ninth Ward contains 45,000 times as much bacteria as considered safe for swimming. To make matters worse, 530 of the city's sewage treatment plants plants remain inoperable. The Army Corps of Engineers has begun pumping the contaminated water into Lake Pontchartrain and the Mississippi River. Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality told reporters Tuesday that there really isn't any alternative to pumping the water into the lake or river. Meanwhile, the Guardian newspaper is reporting New Orleans police have been unable to confirm reports of widespread violence in the New Orleans Superdome last week. For days, news shows reported that a child had been raped, that babies had been killed, and that bodies of murder victims had been found on the Superdome's floor. But according to a report in the Guardian of London, police have not been able to confirm any of these rumors. No witnesses, survivors, or relatives of the survivors have come forward. The New York Times is reporting that two Navy helicopter pilots and their crews have been reprimanded after helping ferry 100 hurricane victims to safety last Tuesday. The commander of the unit criticized them for taking part in the rescue at a time when they were supposed to be delivering food and water to military bases along the Gulf Coast. Commander Michael Holdener defended the reprimand. He said, quote, "We all want to be the guys who rescue people, but they were told we have other missions we have to do right now, and that is not the priority." The commander then ordered a halt to civilian relief efforts. One of the lieutenants who helped with the unauthorized rescue efforts was taken out of the squadron's flying rotation and temporarily assigned to oversee a kennel designed to hold pets of service members. Reporters Without Borders has issued a warning about police violence against journalists working in New Orleans. According to the group, on September 1st, police threatened a reporter and photographer from the Toronto Daily Star at gunpoint because they were seen covering a clash between police and people the police described as looters. When police realized the photographer had snapped photos, they threw him to the ground, grabbed his cameras, and removed the memory cards containing about 350 photographs. His press card was also torn from him. When the photographer asked for his photographs back, police officers threatened to hit him. Police also detained a photographer from the New Orleans-based Times-Picayune after he was seen covering a shootout involving the police. Police smashed all his equipment on the ground. And the website Talking Points Memo is reporting that the former head of FEMA, Joe Albaugh, may stand to profit from the catastrophe in the Gulf region through his various lobbying efforts. President Bush tapped Albaugh to head FEMA after he served as Bush's campaign manager during the 2000 election. He headed FEMA until March 2003, just as the U.S. was launching its invasion of Iraq. Then Albaugh helped form a lobbying firm called New Bridge Strategies in order to help clients, quote, take advantage of business opportunities in the Middle East following the conclusion of the U.S.-led war in Iraq, unquote. New Bridge Strategies was also formed by several top executives from the lobbying firm then known as Barber, Griffith, and Rogers. The head of that firm was Haley Barber, who is now the Republican governor of Mississippi. Earlier this year, Joe Albaugh signed on as a lobbyist for Halliburton subsidiary KBR in order to, quote, educate the congressional and executive branch on defense, disaster relief, and homeland security issues. Just last week, the federal government announced Halliburton would be hired to repair the Gulf Coast military bases damaged by Katrina. And now the Washington Post is reporting Albaugh is also helping Louisiana, quote, coordinate the private sector response to the storm. And in other news, the Senate has announced it'll open confirmation hearings on Monday for Judge John Roberts as Chief Justice of the United States. President Bush has tapped Roberts to replace the late William Rehnquist. He died on Saturday and is being buried today. On Tuesday, his body lay in state at the Supreme Court. In California, the state legislature has voted to allow same-sex couples to marry, making it the nation's first state legislature to deliberately approve same-sex marriages. In Iraq, President Jalal Talabani is claiming Saddam Hussein has confessed to crimes during his regime. Talabani said a judge, quote, was able to extract confessions from the ousted leader. Hussein's trial is scheduled to begin on October 19th. And in Gaza, Palestinian ex-security chief Musa Arafat was killed Tuesday. Arafat was dragged from his Gaza home and shot dead in the street by fellow Palestinians. The attack has been claimed by the Palestinian group, the Popular Resistance Committees. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, there is still no official toll of numbers left dead by the devastation of Hurricane Katrina. But as the Army Corps of Engineers began pumping the water out of the city earlier this week, officials estimated the death toll could be as many as 10,000, making it one of the worst natural disasters in the history of the country. More than 500,000 evacuees from Hurricane Katrina are being relocated to other states across the country. It's a historic exodus, and it's unclear what will happen to them and what support they will receive to try and rebuild their lives. An Associated Press analysis of census data shows the people living in the path of the hurricane's worst devastation were twice as likely as most Americans to be lower income and without a car. The dead and displaced are largely the ones who had nowhere to go and no means to get there. They were the ones who waited for days at the New Orleans Convention Center and at other places throughout the city without adequate food, medicine, housing, and security. And they were mostly Black and largely poor. New Orleans is a city that is almost 70% Black, with nearly 23% of its residents living in poverty. Many African Americans are asking if this calamity would have been allowed to happen if the demographics of the city were different. And they're asking if the response would have been quicker if New Orleans had been a predominantly white, wealthy city. On his way to Louisiana a few days ago, the Reverend Jesse Jackson said racial discrimination and indifference to Black suffering is at the root of the disaster response. He went on to say, quote, "In the same city of New Orleans where slave ships landed, where the legacy of 246 years of slavery and 100 years of Jim Crow discrimination, that legacy is unbroken today." The Reverend Al Sharpton spoke in Houston Saturday and noted the difference between the government's rapid response to the hurricane in Florida last year that hit mostly white upper-middle-class areas and to Hurricane Katrina that hit mostly Black New Orleans and Mississippi.
I feel race was a factor. Why? I remember almost a year ago to the day, I was in Florida when a hurricane was coming, not a .4, not a .5. And I saw the White House move. I saw the governor, the president's brother move. National Guard was already alerted before the storm ever hit. It seems to me that if we can be alert in Palm Beach, Florida, we could have been alert in New Orleans.
Reverend Al Sharpton speaking in Houston Saturday. Many in the hip-hop community have spoken out as well. On Friday night, hip-hop superstar Kanye West appeared on the live NBC telethon and had this to say about the Bush administration's treatment of the mostly Black victims of Hurricane Katrina.
George Bush doesn't care about Black people.
After the program, fellow hip-hop star Diddy told the program Access Hollywood, quote, "I think he spoke from his heart. He spoke what a lot of people feel." And on his Sunday program on radio network Air America, hip-hop luminary Chuck D, formerly of the seminal rap group Public Enemy, read the lyrics to a new song about the hurricane entitled, "Hell No, We Ain't All Right."
Now all these press conferences, breaking news alerts, this just in, while your government looks for a war to win. Flames from the blame game, names, where do I begin? Walls closing in, get some help to my kin. Who cares? While the rest of the Bush nation stares as the drama unfolds, as we, the people under the stairs, 50% of this son of a Bush nation is like hating on Haiti and setting up assassinations. Ask Pat Robertson. Quiz him. Smells like terrorism. Racism in the news, still one-sided views, saying whites find food, pray for the National Guard ready to shoot, because them Blacks, they loot. Fires, earthquakes, tsunamis, I don't mean to scare. Wasn't this written somewhere? Disgraces. All I see is Black faces moved out to all these places. Emergency state, corpses, alligators, and snakes. Big difference between this haze and them diamonds on them VMAs. We better look what's really important under this sun, especially if you're over 21. This ain't no TV show. It ain't no video. This is real, real. Really real. Beyond them same old keep it real quotes from them TV stars driving big rim cars. Streets be flooding, B. No matter where you at, no gas driving is now a luxury. Urgency, a state of emergency, shows somebody's government is far from reality. I see here, we be the new faces of refugees, who ain't even overseas, but here on our knees. Forget the plasma TV, ain't no electricity. New world's upside down and out of order. Shelter, food, what's up? Where's the water? No answers from disaster. Them masses hurting. So who the F we call? Halliburton? Son of a Bush, how are you going to trust that cat to fix things when help is stuck in Iraq, making war plans, taking more stands in Afghanistan? 2,000 soldiers dying in the sand. But that's over there, right? Now what's over here is a noise so loud some can't hear. But on TV I can see bunches of people looking just like me.
Chuck D. of Public Enemy and the radio network Air America. Administration officials have been busy denying that the race of the victims of Hurricane Katrina had anything to do with the slow government response. Bush appeared earlier this week with African-American conservative televangelist T.D. Jakes of Dallas and other local black leaders in an effort to counter the criticism. Last weekend, the highest-ranking African-American in the Bush administration, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, dismissed claims of racism. On the plane trip from Washington to her hometown of Mobile, Alabama, Sunday, Rice said, quote, "Nobody, especially the president, would have left people unattended on the basis of race." Later that day, she had this to say.
"I am an African-American. I'm from Alabama. I can tell you that this response is not a response about color. This is a response about Americans helping Americans. No American wants to see another American suffer. And I don't believe for one minute that anybody allowed people to suffer because they were African-Americans. I just don't believe it."
That was Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice speaking Sunday. Well, in Democracy Now!, producers Sharif Abdelkaddous and John Hamilton reported from New Orleans this weekend. They encountered some of the white local attitudes about race. We're joined now by Sharif Abdelkaddous. Welcome, Sharif.
Hi, Amy. Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you back from New Orleans and Baton Rouge. Can you talk about your experience?
Well, Amy, I think there's serious issues of race and class here that need to be addressed. I mean, you have the initial media portrayal of black hurricane survivors as looters and whites as looking for food, and you heard Kanye West's comments about that earlier. But I mean, just visually, when you're in New Orleans and you see that the vast, vast majority of the victims, the dead and the displaced, are African American, and it belies, I think, a systemic racism there. And when I was on the ground, that was really revealing. I was in the border of New Orleans Parish, of Orleans Parish and Jefferson Parish, where the flooding begins. I was waiting for my colleague John Hamilton, who was out in a boat looking for survivors. And as the sun was setting, dusk set in, three police cars came. And I initially thought they were going to help with the rescue operations, but as it turned out, they were there to take pictures, you know, together of the flooding of the water. And they were armed very heavily. They had pistols, assault rifles, knives, Kevlar, wraparound sunglasses, the whole deal. So I got to talking to them, and I asked them about the reports of looting and violence, and we got to talking about the Ninth Ward, which is one of the poorest and blackest neighborhoods of New Orleans. And one of the policemen turned to me, and I won't forget this because I wrote it down right after, so I remember. He said, "You know, don't take this the wrong way, but the niggers you have in the Ninth Ward, you ain't got niggers like that in the whole world. Those mother blank are crazy." And he went on to say, "When you hear reports of police brutality, you just think about them." So, I mean, this is coming from a police officer who is supposed to be helping out the residents of New Orleans, 80% of whom are black. Later, and the next day as well, in that same area where people launch off to look for survivors, I was speaking with some Jefferson Parish residents, just some local guys, and they also had some comments. We were talking. My colleague John Hamilton was next to me with a camera, and we're going to play this in just a moment. He kept recording, and he was talking. What you're going to hear right now is them talking about the black community in New Orleans. So let's take a listen.
"I wonder how many will come back.
Well, that's what, when they ship them to Texas, man.
What they gain?
Red Sox, yeah.
Lower 20. Good
luck, man. Good luck.
Friday, Saturday.
But I tell you what, you guys, keep track of this. The governor of Texas right now is getting all this great publicity.
He's getting federal money, that's why.
6 months from now, they're going to vote him out of office. The disaster that he brought to Texas is incredible.
Yeah, we're walking out with these little white jaws, glass jaws. Say so crack cocaine wouldn't get wet.
Oh, man, it's unbelievable. But it's unbelievable. Every single person is the same sociology kind of person.
Well, I tell you what, that's the only good thing. And the best thing
before all this started, my wife and I always used to say that they needed to declare martial law here, and the federal government needed to invade this place. And they really did. So they finally did. We have schools that don't exist. The feds are now going to come in and rebuild this whole place. It's going to be much better after than it is now. But y'all have no idea what, you know, what kind of city this is. I mean, it's a fun place, don't get me wrong. As long as you have enough money to live up here. See y'all. Bye.
Some of the men that you recorded, one of them talking about, a little hard to hear, camera down low, but talking about how Texas may be applauded now for taking people in, but in 6 months.
Right, I mean, he was talking about the Texas governors receiving all this praise for accepting all these displaced people into the state, many of whom are in the Astrodome, but saying that he's being applauded now, but you just wait 6 months, he'll be voted out of office. Because of, and this is his words, the problems that he took in. You know, he's dealing basically with them, the black community now. And also talking about how New Orleans itself, and this is a much larger issue that needs to be addressed over and over again, and as the coverage of this disaster continues, is that people are actually considering, will New Orleans be rebuilt? Will these people go back into their community and be a part of that city? And so he's saying, you know, it's going to be much better off now that they're not here. So and another example, which we're going to play in just a moment, John Hamilton, when he was out on the boat looking for survivors with these local New Orleans residents, he spoke with one young white male who was talking about the Ninth Ward. And I think it gives a clear image of what the portrayal is of what people think of the Ninth Ward as. So why don't we listen to that?
Where's the Ninth Ward at? Right here.
The Ninth Ward?
Yeah. Straight back that way.
You ain't getting there.
You don't want to.
You don't want to. Yeah.
You won't make it.
You won't make it. There's too many hot spots. Even if you wanted to, you couldn't get there.
Yeah. What's going on next? That's the
imagine the worst and then times it by 10.
They talk about the Ninth Ward. What do you know about?
Actually, I don't know a whole lot about it, just hearsay, but they told us that they pulled 950 bodies out yesterday morning.
Ninth Ward is just everything bad. Everything, all the shootings you hear about, everything, other than the Superdome, that's where it's going to be, is the Ninth Ward. I hear they're pretty dry over there, but that's the problem, is that they're dry, and that means the looters can get around and just loot everything. And it's probably tearing the place apart. I mean, I actually haven't been there, but only what I hear on the radio. I wouldn't go down there. Not for anything. The only way I'd go in there is if I was in one of these military helicopters, and then still you'd probably get shot at.
Young white male speaking in New Orleans this weekend to our producer, John Hamilton. Sharif Abdelkaddous also with John, describing his experiences as people there talked about race, and we'll continue that discussion in a minute here on Democracy Now!
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 350 radio and TV stations around the country. We are also podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue a discussion about race and the response to Hurricane Katrina with Curtis Muhammad, co-founder of the New Orleans-based organization Community Labor United, joining us from Jackson, Mississippi. We're also joined in New York by David Gladstone, assistant professor of urban planning at the University of New Orleans, and on the phone, Beverly Wright, founder and director of the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice at the University of in New Orleans. Three people displaced from New Orleans right now. David Gladstone, you're here in our studio. Tell us what happened to you, how you got out of New Orleans.
I live and work out at the lakefront, and on Sunday morning I realized I couldn't stay there, so I went, I don't own a car, and lost my last chance to leave with friends, so I checked into a hotel in the downtown area, which a lot of New Orleanians do during hurricanes because they're old buildings and they've weathered many storms. This storm, unfortunately, was unlike any other we've had in the city. I was able to get a hotel room, and I did weather the hurricane itself on Sunday night. Monday morning, it was clear that help wasn't coming anytime soon. People really weren't sure what was happening. They didn't have information. They couldn't go back to their homes. I tried to go back to mine, but the streets were flooded, so I decided to stay another night in the Central Business District. By Tuesday morning, the streets were flooded. My hotel had diesel fuel floating in about 2 feet of water in the lobby. It was a chaotic situation, and I realized I had to leave the hotel, as many other people were doing because of fire hazard. So I found myself on the street with really nowhere to go. I had a couple of bags. I was wandering around Canal Street observing looting and other things in the downtown area. I made my way to one of the residential neighborhoods adjacent to the French Quarter, Faubourg Marigny, where I was able to find some cold beer. New Orleans is New Orleans after all. And I met some people with a car, and I helped them get it out of the city. We left sometime Tuesday night.
What happened when you were walking by a car with military or whoever walking by?
The person I was with had driven with me to back to the Central Business District to find some people he had offered a ride out of the city to as well. And while he was in waist-deep water looking for them, I was standing by the car when some official people on a Caterpillar tractor pulled up to me and were screaming at me to move the car, even though they could get around it. Yelled back that it wasn't my car and I didn't have the keys, and I was yelling for the owner of the car to come back and move it. And in the yelling and screaming, at one point the officer removed his gun from his holster and pointed it right at me. And then another one jumped off the Caterpillar and butted me up against the side of a building with his what looked like an M16 rifle or something like that. And it was really at that point I realized that social order, at least as I knew it, had broken down in the city, and that I had to get out. Fortunately, I was able to do that.
What about these descriptions of looting? The now famous contrast of pictures, AP showing a black person carrying a bag, saying one of the looters, and then AFP, Agence France-Presse, showing two white people saying they had taken food and water, you know, to survive.
Yeah, I think it's really a shame that we've been hearing so many reports in the media linking looting with race. To begin with, most of the looting I observed on Canal Street and in the French Quarter consisted basically of people taking necessities like food and water, anything they could eat like candy, because most people I spoke with felt that they were on their own, that they were, whether it was well-founded or not, they believed that they were on their own and that they had to survive. I did see some people taking clothes and things like that, but by far, most of the people I observed looting in shops were taking necessities.
Beverly Wright, also with us, founder and director of the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice. Where are you now?
I'm in Atlanta, Georgia.
You're still in Atlanta.
Yes, still in Atlanta.
What about this discussion of will New Orleans be rebuilt? I thought about after 2001, the attacks, if anyone said, will New York be rebuilt? That was not the question. It's how it will be rebuilt. But there is this question, will it even be? Almost a sense of, is it worth rebuilding? Your response.
Yes, I believe that New Orleans will be rebuilt because New Orleans is a world-class city. I believe, however, that these questions are posed because of the way that New Orleans is being perceived at the present moment. And that is that it is a city that had a majority African-American population, and that that population is acting in a way that we should less civilized than what we should be acting under these times of duress. So people are saying, well, maybe we shouldn't build it. On the other hand, I really believe that developers, some of them are doing a breakdance at this moment as they watch so many African-Americans being removed from the city, of course, because of these circumstances, because now they will have a chance to rebuild it the way that they'd like to build it, and that is without us. You hear people say that the city of New Orleans will be bigger, it will be better, it will be stronger, and we also know that the plan is for it to be whiter, and that is one of the reasons that those of us who are scattered all over do plan to return. We are in the process of trying to organize in some way that we will be at the table for the rebuilding of our particular community. But what is happening in New Orleans and the way some of it is being reported is no different from the way we were being reported before the hurricane. And so you basically have all of the prejudice and racist kinds of feelings that people have about us being played out in the media. Now, I just have to say that some of the coverage has been absolutely extraordinary. I have seen reporters absolutely say that it is really a disgrace that some of the pictures are being shown over and over again because what they really see are people trying to survive. As a sociologist, you know, we were taught in introductory sociology about what happens when you have a breakdown of norms where everything is chaotic. The behavior that we're seeing in New Orleans is very similar to what you would see any place in the world under these conditions. And I believe that we were ill-prepared for this storm. I believe that our government was very late in stepping in. And a lot of what is happening is predictable. Absolutely predictable based on human nature, and we have not received what I consider to be the appropriate reaction by our government in a timely manner. I can't speak for what's happening now. I think that because so much attention has been given to the city and the elderly and the children and then the violence, that we are getting a very strong response from the government at this point. But I have to tell you, I have friends who went back into my community day before yesterday, and I live in what's called New Orleans East, which is predominantly African-American and middle to upper-class people. And he had a big truck, and he said he had to drive on the opposite side of the interstate and that there were thousands of people still sitting on the interstate trying to get out of the lower night ward. I do agree with Dr. Gladstone that there is a lot of looting, that there's, at night especially, people have guns and they're taking whatever they need, and if you have it, they'll take it from you because of this desperate feeling that a lot of people are having. And you have to remember that we had a serious crime problem in our city before the hurricane, so those people are still there, and you can expect that they're going to act the way they have always acted.
Curtis Muhammad is also on the line with us. He is from New Orleans right now in Jackson, Mississippi, former SNCC organizer, co-founder of Community Labor United in New Orleans. Curtis, this weekend there'll be a meeting in Baton Rouge of black leaders talking about rebuilding New Orleans. As we observe that this question is being asked right now, will New Orleans be built as opposed to how will it be rebuilt? But can you talk about how this whole hurricane is being framed and who will be involved in the rebuilding.
How are you?
It's good to have you with
and
us.
And hi, Beverly.
How are you?
Well, I think there are two things where we started this process of talking to our people about how to move. First of all, that's what we do. We've been doing community forums for about 8 or 9 years in New Orleans under something we call Community Labor United, a coalition of progressive organizations. And so when this happened and we found ourselves scattered everywhere and we were all watching the news and we realized that we had our people just all over the South, North, flying them all over the country. So we began to try to gather ourselves and talk about what we needed. And one consensus emerged out of those phone calls and emails, and that is we could not depend on our local, state, or national government for our future. That it was very clear that without the people standing and demanding something in a real serious way, that we would not get our due. Now, this thing was so blatant. This thing was just so blatant. And there's been so much skating and sliding around the facts of this thing. And we're looking at it on TV, and that's what makes it so hard for me. I mean, I saw T.D. Jakes on the on being interviewed, and I've forgotten who interviewed him. It was on CNN, I think. And the interviewer just tried to push him and said, Reverend Jakes, just tell me how you feel in your gut. Just in your heart, was this racism? And he just kept running from that issue. And it's very few people who have really walked into that peace. I mean, here we are watching this thing happen, hearing the reporters talk about ambulances picking up people from the mostly predominantly white and upper middle class hospital at Tulane University, picking people up to evacuate them, and going right past the charity hospital where most of the blacks were. And we had these reports of nurses using pumps by hand to keep people alive and stashing the dead in the staircase. And yet they were going uptown to empty out the predominantly white and middle-class hospitals. And we were still skating. Now, that convinced us that we had no caretakers. You know, those the mayor at one point goes into the Superdome and goes into the convention center and says, just go walk. So don't wait for help. Just get on the highway and walk out of here. That actually happened. And they stopped them. They set up checkpoints and would not let the people leave the city, for fear they were going to loot the dry towns, white towns, Kenner, Metairie, up the road. And they started locking these shelters at night so people could not sneak away. And no help was still coming. Now, somebody break into a place and get water and food, and we call it looting, and people are dying. And Bush, the president, finally shows up 6 days later, and he says zero tolerance for people who break into places to get food and water. That's the same as looting. How can you call looting when the whole town almost is underwater and people are starving and nobody's been to see about them for 6 days? And those people are being criminalized and thrown in jail as we speak. So when we gathered our forces, we began to travel through the shelters so that we could locate. We couldn't get cooperation from the government of where they were taking our people. But we just started going city to city up the highway. In every city, as we went out I-10 west, we traveled all the way to Houston. We started at Baton Rouge. Everything was filled: churches, gymnasiums, civic centers, dormitories of college campuses where the students had brought their families into their dormitories. But when we would go to the public shelters, they were almost like prisons. You could hardly get in. There was all kind of criteria for how you could get in to see the people. That was almost like visiting somebody in prison. the people didn't have access to the world around them for fear again, because on TV they have been criminalized already. So though the communities were really willing to accept them, they were not willing for these people to walk the streets of their town. They were eating sweets and coats. Still, to the day I came to this radio, to this studio this morning, having driven from Houston. Every little town between Baton Rouge and Houston had shelters with our people, and they were all managed by FEMA and Homeland Security and soldiers and National Guards, and being the ability to go visit these people was like tremendously hard work. By the time we got to Houston, we had learned a little lesson. We learned if we took a already white volunteer as our leader to the shelters, we could enter without any problems, without any red tape. We was allowed to enter. So we are convinced that the racism about the New Orleans black population, the black poor population, is so tremendous and so negligent, and we don't know the reasons. And maybe it's so all black people. Maybe it's that just we just have this tremendous universal hatred for dark skin. I don't know what it is. But we watched blatant racism. We watched our government, whether it is local, state, or national, and I would rather say state or national, because the local government has no National Guard. It has no helicopters. It has no big boats. It doesn't have the wherewithal to have moved 150,000 people trapped in New Orleans underwater. The state and the feds are the culprits. And though they have not joined the international court, there must be a people's court somewhere that can charge wrongful death, that can charge murder, because that's what we have witnessed.
Curtis Muhammad is with Community Labor United. David Gladstone in the studio with us, Assistant Professor of Urban Planning at University of New Orleans, Beverly Wright on the line from Atlanta, Xavier University in New Orleans. All three from New Orleans, all three in diaspora right now. David Gladstone, this rebuilding issue of who gets to decide.
Well, I think when we talk about rebuilding the city, the first major issue that comes to my mind is some of the environmental problems that undoubtedly will arise now that most of the city was flooded underwater. New Orleans has many brownfield sites and at least one Superfund site, a 46-acre Agriculture Street landfill site, which I believe is submerged or was submerged underwater. I think the city will need a lot of remediation. I'm not an expert in that area, so I can't comment on whether or not the extent of it or what is needed there. But my feeling is that that will be a first order of business. Excuse me. Now, provided that environmental conditions are sound and people can return there, I think the city will need to do two things. One will be to convince the people who left to come back. I think the New Orleans without the people who left is just simply not the same city.
Some are talking about it as a New Orleans of casinos and oil.
Well,
without the people who live there.
In my experience, the culture of New Orleans is sold in the French Quarter, but it's produced elsewhere in many of the neighborhoods that have been devastated by this storm and flooding. And in order to get the real cultural producers back in the city, I think they will need to feel safe that this won't happen again. And they'll also need to have adequate housing, which raises a big issue in my mind, because most people in New Orleans are renters, and most of the people who are poor and African American are renters. And the private sector cannot come back in and build housing and charge market rates and have people able to afford it. So there's going to be need to be a rather large scale public works program in New Orleans or some kind of subsidies. I hear companies like Bank of America advertise that they have $750 billion that they want to invest in struggling communities. Well, why not in New Orleans?
Curtis Muhammad, we just have a few more seconds. Your final comment, and tell us where the meeting is this weekend in Baton Rouge.
The meeting will be at Southern University in Baton Rouge, and on this rebuilding question, $10 billion that has been approved, they have already subsidized the oil drilling rigs. They've already subsidized the casinos. This city is intended, without the people's input, to go forward with the casinos, with the condominiums, with the Garden District, with the French Quarters. While I agree with the young man who spoke, I don't think that there is a desire of the leadership of this project, New Orleans, to bring those poor people back. They're scattering them as far as California. 300 have arrived in a school with a former teacher of mine. They are all the way up in D.C. These are poor people. If they find a way to live, they're going to stay there. If the people rise up, which we are pushing for, this is part of what our meeting is about. If the people demand oversight and transparency of all funds collected on their behalf and make priority the reintegration and the construction of places to live for displaced people rather than casinos and hotels and condominiums, the people will come back.
Curtis Muhammad, I want to thank you for being with us, and we'll continue to talk to you of the Community Labor United from New Orleans, now in Jackson, Mississippi. Beverly Wright of Xavier University in New Orleans, now in Atlanta, and David Gladstone, the University of New Orleans Professor of Urban Planning, now in New Jersey. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, a micro radio station is being set up at the Houston Astrodome. We'll go to Pacifica Station KPFT, involved in that new form of communication for thousands of internally displaced people. Stay with us. Storm, Damon and Naomi here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on hundreds of community and public radio and TV stations, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. I am Amy Goodman. Tens of thousands of displaced people from New Orleans have been living in the Houston Astrodome for the past few days. Most of them don't know what the future holds or even the latest news and updates on their situation. To combat this, relief volunteers and independent media organizers like the Prometheus Radio Project have gotten permission from the Federal Communications Commission and the City of Houston to build a low-power 30-watt radio station to provide critical information to people displaced in the area. They're waiting for final permission from the officials at the Astrodome to go on the air and looking to bring in equipment, radios for all the potential listeners and batteries to make it possible. Democracy Now! Is helping to make possible the thousands of radios that people will need to get this communication. We go now to Houston to speak with Tish Stringer, an indie media activist who teaches at Rice University, and Renee Feltz. She's news director at Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, has been spending a lot of time inside the Astrodome getting the voices of people out to a larger community. Thank you both for coming into KPFT to speak with us.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Tish, why don't you begin by talking about what this micro radio project is all about?
Well, when people first started to go into the Astrodome to speak with the people who had moved from the Superdome into the Astrodome and also from surrounding areas in New Orleans into the Astrodome, it was really clear that communication and information was a pressing need. Communication as a human right was really an issue in there. People had no information about the location of their loved ones. There was a real difficulty getting information for basic things like when to eat, where to eat, how to get my child into school, how to look for jobs, transportation, really basic issues. There was no circulation of information going on in the early stages. And media activists in Houston talked about this and decided that really radio would be the perfect medium to address this. So we started talking to Prometheus Radio Project about how we should go about doing this as a micro radio. And we decided to apply to the FCC for legal low power FM, which they granted really quickly. Within a day, we had licenses from the FCC. We've had the three licenses in our hands since Sunday. We've been ready to go. We have a whole radio station in boxes ready to go since Sunday. So now it's Wednesday, and we're really hoping to get on the air any moment to address this need for communication information from the public service officials, from organizations in Houston that are offering aid to the people who are staying in the Astrodome, as well as taking the pressure off public service people and volunteers in the Astrodome who are being asked for information constantly.
Renee Feltz, can you talk about reporting inside and about the setting up of the radio and what people are saying inside?
Inside, people are saying that they really want information about what's going on back at home. They lack that information, and that's one thing that that they're searching for. They're also, like Tish said, just seeking information about basic services, but as well, they want to learn how to sign up their kids for school. We have this week about 2,000 people signing up for classes, and I think that they could also seek to use a radio station as a way to get out to their loved ones where they are, and perhaps the audio that's broadcast over the micro radio station here could be archived and used by other community radio stations around the country for people to hear the voices of their loved ones and know how to contact them.
I wanted to go for a moment to just one of the many people that you've recorded, Renee, talking about his experience in New Orleans.
They just left us there to die. They didn't care about us at all. Man, I've been out there 7 days. 3 days straight, I've been helping people, getting people out of houses and stuff. I had a boat. I was helping people get people out of houses and stuff, older people and children and stuff, you know. My boat sunk. Police rolled right past me like nothing ain't happened, you know. Ain't nobody was helping us. We was helping ourselves. And they talking about everybody looting and all this and that, you know. Hey, we had to do what we had to do to survive. Everybody out there. It just was messed up. A lot of people lost their family members. Right now, I'm on my own. I don't know where none of my family at. By myself, none of my family.
One of the voices of people in the Houston Astrodome. There are a lot of people, Tish. A lot of the media is talking about how happy people are to be in the Astrodome right now. Renee, your sense of that, and also the most recent move to say that some—I think it was what is it—a thousand people should leave to go to Galveston.
I think the original request was that 2,000 people would go to Galveston, and what officials are trying to do here, they say, is lighten the load. As people probably have heard, Governor Rick Perry has already said that our large, very large state of Texas is apparently full to capacity and can take no more people. So that's what their argument is also for the Astrodome. They say they want to make people more comfortable. So yesterday, officials with the Red Cross offered to people an opportunity after they had been these flood victims to go shack up on cruise ships for an estimated 6 months in the Galveston area, another area that's subject to hurricanes, of course, in the Gulf Coast region. And what happened there is that people in essentially refused to go. They were unable to get the buses filled up to leave. It was interesting, the wording they used. They said that the elderly, people that generally would need a large support system around them, but would also basically be unable to really refuse to go, they were saying that the elderly had first priority to get on these cruise ships. Also, the buses that have been out there and available for people to take to other parts of the country, Denver, Utah, Michigan, have been largely leaving with just 12 people on these 55-seat buses.
Tish Stringer, what is the response of the officials at the Astrodome to setting up the micro-radio station?
Well, unfortunately, Amy, I wish I could tell you really in detail about that, but basically we're being told we have a lot more pressing issues to worry about than this radio station. That's basically it. We wait and wait outside this one official's office who's the person keeping this from happening, and we've talked to her every day, and every day she's telling us to wait. The first day we talked to her, she said, before I can let you on the air, I need to know that you're going to distribute radios. I need to know that you're going to distribute a very specific kind of radio that she laid out what kind it would be. She said, I need you to have 10,000 radios in your hand before you can go on the air. In one day, we got 10,000 radios. We have 10,000 radios right now ready to distribute in the Astrodome. We are just waiting on this one low-level bureaucrat, and I really feel like it's an example. As we saw the immediate need for food and water of people in New Orleans, the food and water was there, and bureaucracy dragged its feet. And now the immediate need for information, communication, we are ready to go. We've been ready to go with licenses since Sunday. And again, government, as we see it structured here, is failing. We are trying to help ourselves. We're trying to do the media, and we're just waiting for bureaucracy to...
Tish Stringer and Renee Feltz were also joined by Hannah Sassaman of the Prometheus Radio Project. Hannah, how does this micro radio station, if it does go on air, fit into the larger low-power movement in this country? And what can be done in Houston to actually make this happen?
Well, it's important for people to realize that this station is part of a movement of communities determining themselves that they need media that they're making locally that serve them. These resources are available, as Tish and Renee have been saying, and we're just being stymied at the door, as we've been stymied for building community radio stations all across the United States, low-power stations, by Congress, who will not let them into the big cities where they can make the biggest difference. The roadblocks that are before us need to be overcome immediately, especially for the national community and the international community to hear these stories, to hear the news that these people in the Astrodome and living in shelters all across the South need to tell. This morning, the Youth Media Council reported that only 22 out of the 1,300 stories on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox have focused on the race and class issues that the people who are living in these new communities have been suffering. We have to immediately begin shifting the public's view that this is purely a national disaster. And people listening to this program right now can help by making a donation to the Houston Indie Media Radio Project at PrometheusRadio.org. You can also fight to expand low-power FM to make sure that the next time we're suffering nationally and locally in these situations, we have our own radio stations that we can use to help each other in crises like these.
I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Hannah Sassaman of the Prometheus Radio Project speaking to us from Philadelphia, and Renee Feltz and Tish Stringer speaking to us from the studios of a community radio station of Pacifica Radio KPFT in Houston. Tish Stringer, grassroots indie media activist, teaches at Rice University. Renee Feltz, news director at KPFT. That does it for today's broadcast. Tomorrow we'll look at the international response and the opportunities missed, why a naval ship was told to turn around when it had food and water. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.